Well, we tried to find this guy, and we even left messages with his mother and grandmother somewhere in Texas, but we could never find him. Take a look at Juan Carlos's conversation with the UFO guy.
What do you think? Do you believe in UFOs?
Oh, yeah, yes, sir. They're out there, man. They're out there, man. I got pictures of fluorescent grape lights. They're out there, man.
Do you think there's like little green men out there?
Man, I see them. They got them little grapes and stuff. I'm flying in the plane. I'm always hallucinating. But who really knows what I'm looking at? You know what I'm saying? I'm always hallucinating. I'm flying in the plane. I'm hallucinating. I don't even know. But who really knows? We're going out to like the Air Force One. We're finding all that stuff. Figure something out.
Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme Frank Johnson of the Ancient Aliens Debunked website and regular guest on our Fireside Nephilim Boys sessions. For the last 4 to 5 years or so, Frank has been writing for Chris White's blog at ancientaliensdebunked.com, the website that Chris White set up in connection with his excellent debunkumentary, which is what he calls them, Ancient Aliens Debunked, critiquing the History Channel's Ancient Aliens TV series, or series of series, which debunkumentary has been seen by countless millions of people and is still available online, and of course highly recommended by me. But Frank's writing there is not just limited to that subject, and no doubt we'll be touching on some of the other things that Frank writes about as we have this chat here today. Frank, welcome back to TMR.
Hi, thanks for having me, Julian. It's always fun to talk to you. So just your friendly neighborhood Frank Johnson dropping in for a visit.
Excellent. It is great to speak to you again. Although I don't know what you look like because you always appear as Spider-Man. But that isn't what you really look like, is it? Please do tell me.
You know, that is actually a real picture of me, and that's the closest to a real picture I would be prepared to share.
And you're going to be sharing with us today your latest theory that the dinosaurs helped build the pyramids, is that right?
That's right. I think we can make a solid case that, large dinosaurs, plant eaters, of course, like, you know, Brachiosaurus were used to create the pyramids because, you know, they were docile enough and strong enough to haul those heavy blocks. They did try meat eaters at first, but they just found that the casualty rate was just way too high. So they switched into Brachiosaurus later on. Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about that today.
I'm resisting the temptation to start pulling that to bits there, Frank. But I think people will be delighted and relieved to know that we're actually not going to be talking about that theory. Just generally speaking then, how are you doing these days?
As the French say, comme ça, comme ça, things are okay. Things are could be better. They could be worse.
You recovered from talking about the Nephilim fairy and and New Year's Day.
Yeah, that's off my chest now. So
I did notice that you've stopped putting up the same picture of Jeff Goldblum every day. So I was slightly worried about you for a while.
Yeah, I kind of got a little bored with Facebook. At the moment, and for a few months, I've been kind of unemployed. So a lot of my Facebook profile pictures and moving the Jeff Goldblum picture around, we're kind of done that on downtime at work. Don't tell anyone, but
you didn't want to do it in your own time.
Well, you know, sometimes on a break at work, I would do it, or, you know, but sometimes if there's nothing going on, just do it to save my sanity. Yeah.
Well, how did you come to write for Chris White's blog in the first place?
Yeah, so years ago, when he had said he needed some people to help do some research for the Ancient Aliens Debunked movie, I was one of those people who helped do that research, and I ended up starting to do the blog for him.
Are you in touch with Chris at all these days? Because he's taken a break, hasn't he, from that form of ministry anyway?
He has, yeah. If I send him an email, he will sometimes respond if he's got time. Mm. We're not in like in regular contact, yeah. Although I would like to, you know, talk with him more if he wanted to, but he's just very busy with his own thing. So, and I completely understand and respect that too. So,
well, absolutely. Yeah, I'll be interested to see if he does return to that form of ministry, and if so, what projects he does in future.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about the Ancient Aliens TV series itself, something that I did actually have a chat about with Chris White in the very early days of this podcast. We didn't really go into a great deal of detail about it at the time, and it may seem a little odd to be revisiting this subject now, but I was reminded about it just before Christmas when a whole load of the series was shown on UK television. I don't know whether it was for the first time, but it was the first time that I'd noticed it being on UK television. So people did get exposed to all of that business at the end of 2016 here in the UK. So let's start then with a basic intro for anyone who might not have seen those programs. Could you tell us, Frank, then what the Ancient Alien series essentially are and, you know, what the basic idea is with them?
Yeah, so the Ancient Aliens TV series is basically a show I think that was started by the History Channel back maybe around like 2008 or so. And, you know, content-wise, it was basically kind of building on the foundation of like Eric Von Daniken from the 60s and 70s, the Chariots of the Gods stuff, but also I think incorporating a lot of stuff that had come onto the table since then with other Fringe authors. So that's why you'll see people like David Childress, Phil Coppens, and kind of newer people to the party, like Crazy Hair Giorgio, who kind of played on his crazy hair theme, and people who were building on Von Daniken's foundation and maybe who had gone in other directions besides just aliens. So you kind of got a little diffusionist stuff in there with Childress and maybe a little new agey stuff, maybe some stuff built on Graham Hancock's work. So a lot of like ancient mysteries, Atlantis type of stuff kind of rolled in there and kind of given an alien spin, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it did seem to be a melting pot of all sorts of ideas. But as you say, it does very much seem to center in the Eric Von Daniken idea here. And I've got his book here, Chariots of the Gods, which I told you before the interview I managed to buy for 40p from a charity shop.
And I said you paid too much.
You did. Which has the subtitle, Was God an Astronaut? Which pretty much sums up the basic thesis of the series, doesn't it? This ancient astronaut idea, and reinterpreting pretty much all of ancient religious mythology and symbology as contact with extraterrestrials, and therefore gods, in inverted commas, are treated as alien beings. That sort of idea, isn't it?
Yeah, basically, yeah. So just exactly like you said, they spin ancient mythology into a space opera, basically, yeah. I think one of the biggest components of that is to discredit the Bible to a certain extent, maybe not deliberately on the behalf of the human components, but maybe on a spiritual level. There's some spiritual things behind the scenes, perhaps, that is one link in the chain to try to discredit the Bible and Christianity in particular, by just kind of positing this astronaut theory. You know, it kind of is a theory that flows well with evolution, you know, because some people may feel, oh, evolution disproved God. Well, okay, maybe there's something else. Maybe, you know, I think within us, we have like a spiritual need. And so they start looking for something else. And then this ancient aliens thing is there. Maybe that's something they latch on to, you know, so.
Yes, we'll get back to that because that's an important aspect to the whole thing, I think. So I mentioned this book, Chariots of the Gods. So this was published in 1968. So this is not the origin of the ancient astronaut hypothesis. It goes back before that. Do you know much about the origins of that idea?
I have read a little bit about it, yeah. So the origins of it, in reading Jason Colavito's blogs, he kind of has theorized that a lot of it came from the writings of H.P. Lovecraft with his Cthulhu stuff. In his fiction and different things like that, he kind of spun these space aliens as like gods and stuff. And so a lot of these like stories involved cultists of these gods who are basically just worshiping these weird aliens and stuff, you know, and so that's where he kind of points to for that theory being born. And I think he also ties in to Helena Blavatsky's theosophy stuff too, because I think some of her stuff kind of leans in that direction too.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Can I just double check? So yeah. Lovecraft, what sort of time are we talking there? Is it the early 20th century?
I think early 20th century, yeah. He was writing around the same time as like Robert E. Howard. So almost in the pulp era of the 30s, but not quite. I think maybe the 20s and 30s. somewhere in that time frame.
Now, I find it interesting that you mentioned Helena Blavatsky, mm-hmm. a theosophy movement which was started in the latter quarter of the 19th century, mm-hmm. and her leanings in that direction. I'll come back to that in a moment. Mm-hmm. I understand that there was a writer called Harold Wilkins who started popularizing the ancient astronaut idea in the middle of the 20th century. And Jason Colavito, you just mentioned, says that he plagiarized some of Helena Blavatsky's writing. So I do wonder if there is some sort of connection back there. Maybe we're talking about the same article by Colavito. I don't know.
Yeah, I think one common thing they all have is they kind of, if they don't outright subscribe to the alien theory, like maybe Blavatsky might have been too early for the alien thing. They did at least subscribe to like Atlantean narrative, you know, the theory of Atlantis. So kind of a lost history sort of thing. And that comes up in, I think, well, for sure, Blavatsky's work. She was referencing lost tablets and mentioning ancient civilizations. And just looking at Wilkins here, he had books about treasure hunting and claims about Atlantis. So there again is the Atlantis component. Even like Robert E. Howard, who wrote the Conan stories, him and Lovecraft were like buddies, you know, and they kind of crossed over literary universes a little too. So he had a big Conan the Barbarian had some ties to Atlantis also. So you have kind of that lost history, and then you kind of cross over into the alien territory with Lovecraft. So it's kind of all, like you said, a melting pot of sorts with ancient aliens. Yeah.
It is, yes. It's interesting, actually, how those ideas tend to cross-fertilize, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I actually have a copy here on my desk of Madame Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. And it seems fairly clear to me, anyway, from looking at book two here, that she did teach that ancient people had been visited by beings from other planets, mm-hmm. although she seems to have conceived of them as spiritual beings rather than physical aliens, as people normally think about them. And I was going to read, Frank, from a bit of her book, but she's not at all easy to follow, so I thought I would read a paragraph by Jason Colavito that sums this up. So I'm reading here from his article called The Theosophical Roots of the Ancient Astronaut Theory from the Secret Doctrine, H.P. Blavatsky, 1888. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'll link to that and the Secret Doctrine so people can check this out. Colavito writes, quote, "In the second volume of The Secret Doctrine on the Origins of Humanity, Anthropogenesis, Blavatsky speculated on the possibility of life on other worlds, arguing that the ancients were already aware of spiritually advanced creatures on planets such as Venus, and that these creatures, which she viewed as largely spiritual rather than biological entities, following the medieval Christian idea that angels resided on the crystal spheres associated with each planet in geocentric orbit, had visited the Earth and aided the evolution of humanity. In this, Blavatsky generated an early form of the ancient astronaut theory, which would blossom into its modern form after European writers rediscovered it through its transmission in the work of later theosophists like Annie Besant, A.E. Powell, who were more explicit about the alien visitors, and the fiction pulp writers like H.P. Lovecraft." End quote. So clearly she did believe in intelligent beings that had evolved to higher states of consciousness on different planes of existence, that sort of ascended master kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you can see, you know, in the Ancient Alien series, how these two ideas, the aliens out there in outer space, as it were, and the aliens in there in different dimensions of reality, so to speak, those two things are interconnected. Those two ideas dovetail incredibly well, don't they?
Yeah, they certainly do. And certainly people who have built on Blavatsky's work have had no problems claiming that like the ascended masters and whatever were aliens. I had actually in 2008, when I was getting back into the UFO stuff, I had read articles saying that there were, you know, spiritual beings who were from the planet Venus and they were ascended and evolved to a higher plane of existence. Yeah. So it's definitely the same sort of idea. Definitely.
Do you know anything about the influence that Carl Sagan might have had on this? I came across that he and another astrophysicist had written a book in the 1960s popularizing the idea that there might have been alien contact, just as an idea, not to promote the kind of ideas of von Däniken, but just the idea that we may have been contacted. Do you think that might have had any role in popularizing the idea?
It certainly could have, yeah. I mean, I kind of know a little bit about that, but not much. I remember, I think even von Däniken or somebody had tried to quote him on that as like a proof quote or something. And then he Sagan was kind of like backpedaling on it, saying like, no, that's not what I meant kind of thing. So I think it was definitely exploited by the people who were trying to latch on to somebody with some credibility. And I think Sagan, a lot of his stuff was kind of thought experiments, wasn't it? I only watched like one episode of Cosmos back in the 90s on an old VHS tape. But the one I watched, he was like working with like a hyperdimensional cube and kind of just talking about theories and stuff. So if he was talking about ancient aliens or whatever, my guess would be as a thought experiment.
Yes. Yeah. I totally agree with you. I seem to remember him speculating about what life might be in some other solar system or something, that it might not even be based upon carbon. As you say, that's thought experiment territory, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
We have mentioned why do we think people might be attracted to the idea of this, and we've said that there may be some sort of spiritual element to this.
Mm-hmm.
When I was thinking about this, I was thinking about that film, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is actually one of my favorite films. I think it's fantastic.
Mm.
And every time I see that film, it's very obvious to me that there is a religious or a sort of existential dimension to that film, in the sense that there is that kind of search for meaning, mm-hmm. a way to transcend this world in some way that these people go through in following up this almost prophetic vision they get about what's going to happen, you know. So that whole mm-hmm. feeling there about the possibility of encountering otherworldly realities and otherworldly beings, I think that whole feeling is very much behind the ancient aliens phenomenon itself. Do you think that it's working in that sort of existential way?
Yeah, I think definitely ancient aliens is appealing to that sort of dynamic, sure. You know, science has kind of gotten rid of God, and, you know, our educational institutions have kind of, quote unquote, debunked the Bible. And really, I don't believe they have. But, you know, they've gotten rid of God. God is dead, according to them. And, you know, mankind, we have that spiritual need in us. And so we're latching on to other things. And that's during the time when Ancient Aliens or Von Daniken came out and was popular, this is kind of gaining traction, I think, with kind of the common people who were taught in school, okay, you know, evolution is true. I guess we're all just animals, you know, and maybe who didn't pursue it any further than that. And so they were buying into this alien thing as, okay, maybe that someone created us. Okay. Because deep in our heart, I think we know we were created, and that was playing to that thing within us, I think. And so there you have the alien thing. Yeah.
There's also been that creeping realization that it's incredibly difficult and maybe actually impossible to account for the beginnings of life on Earth. And we've had people like Francis Crick, I think it was, who suggested what he called directed panspermia, that mm-hmm. maybe life was seeded in some way by technologically advanced extraterrestrials who sent it into mm-hmm. outer space and eventually it arrived here. So that would seem to give credence to the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just the very difficulty of coming up with life in a materialistic way.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, because the whole naturalist explanation, you have to have so many chains of coincidence that, I don't know, to me it reaches unbelievability. But yeah, and so just adding the existence of one form of life evolving, let alone the countless stuff we see here on Earth, I mean, you kind of can see, you know, there is a creator's hand at work. Even someone who's not a believer in any real sense, like Hugo de Garis, has said that mathematically he sees there's enough evidence that there's some sort of creator being, and he doesn't subscribe to any religious view. So
indeed, it's interesting with that it doesn't actually get rid of the problem, does it? Because if you say that some alien being or some universal spermia or whatever it is has floated across mm-hmm. to cause life on this planet, you still have the question, yeah, but how come that came around in the first place? But
yeah,
just pushes the whole thing back mm-hmm. one step. Okay, one thing I wanted to say here before we move on to the next section is, I don't know what your position on this is, Frank, but I wanted to say that I am not actually averse to the idea in principle that there may be, you know, life on other planets, an intelligent life on other planets. Really don't mm-hmm. dismiss that idea. My Christian belief is quite consistent with that. I think it was the Christian philosopher Thomas Morris said that mm-hmm. the existence of life is actually more probable on a theistic view of the world than it is on an atheistic view of the world, because on materialism, life is relatively improbable, you know, given the resources of the cosmos. But on a theistic perspective, God can just do what he likes. He's not limited mm-hmm. by chance. So, you know, there could be as many civilizations out there as God chooses there to
right.
be. So I feel that's quite consistent. But the question is whether we've actually been mm-hmm. visited and what the evidence is for those visitations. I don't know whether you have anything to say about that.
Well, I kind of see that then as like a two-part question. Is one, are there aliens? And two, have they visited us? So to answer that first part, I think, like you said, with God, I mean, if he really wanted other civilizations out there, they would be out there. My thought on this, these are just thoughts. I mean, don't like take these as any sort of thing, because it's all just speculation on my part. But even within our own solar system, there's some candidates for life, according to science. They think perhaps there might be some bacteria on Mars. And yeah, I could see that as possible. They're also saying like some of the moons around Jupiter and Saturn are very likely candidates because they think there's water there. So science is like very firm that water is an essential thing for life. And from our perspective, I don't think God is limited to making all life requiring water, you know. Certainly any episode of Star Trek I've seen, there's aliens there's that don't need water, you know. So, I mean, I don't think we can assign that sort of limit. So even if there is water in our system, I don't think there's necessarily life. And so to make this a longer answer, I think the spots in our solar system that could have life, they may have it. But here's my theory about the solar system. You know, in the Bible, we do see like the heavens declare the glory of God, right? And I think if you look at Earth, it's in, they call it the Goldilocks, because it's the perfect conditions for life as we know it. Well, let's start with Mercury. It doesn't have an atmosphere. It's too hot and it's too cold, depending on which side of the planet you're on. So that one's out. Then you got Venus, too hot. Atmosphere is toxic. You got Earth, just right. Mars, again, you have no water or very little water, and it's kind of a dead planet. And then the rest of the solar system is gas giants. I mean, we don't even think about those, but perhaps some of the moons, maybe we'll see. So I think if you look at it like that, with the knowledge we have now, life as we know it on Earth is not going to live on anywhere else in the solar system. And to me, that tells me maybe God is telling us that we on Earth are unique. Our planet is unique. Our life here is unique. Humanity is unique above all the life on planet Earth, you know.
That's certainly an interesting perspective. And you say this is not something you're saying that you're committed to 100%. But I'm going to jump back and say immediately, okay, we may be unique in this solar system, but what about other solar systems, of which there are countless billions, so we're given to understand? And indeed, in the Ancient Alien series themselves, they do say, well, there are these exoplanets, you know, and other solar systems which are in themselves in habitable zones with respect to their own suns. And so why should they not have life? And from my, you know, my own theistic perspective, I think I can't think of why there shouldn't be. I mean, I don't know that there are, but my worldview allows for that.
Well, and, you know, playing Socratic method, why should they? But no, you're right. Yeah, why? What if there is life on those other planets? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I suppose all I was saying was, I mean, I started off by saying that I'm not averse to the idea. That's the position I have. I mean, so, you know, I could imagine some people saying, oh, you know, you're a Christian, you don't want there to be life on other planets for some reason. I don't know why people might think that, but I have a feeling some people might, and I'm saying...
People would say that.
I would say immediately, yeah, if God wants there to be, there are. Let's talk about the next thing, you know?
Yeah, that does bring us into the next part of the question, then. So even if they found life in our own system of some sort, that doesn't mean anything for the existence of God or the Bible, for sure. And I think if you consider life, and especially intelligent life in other solar systems, you have to consider a few things. First and foremost is, have they visited us? I would say no, I don't think so. Even when you look at the abduction phenomena, alien abduction phenomena, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, I think that has another explanation. Then if you look at another aspect of it, when we get into eschatology and stuff, the heavens are going to be rolled up like a scroll. So that tells me like the heavens as we know them are all going to be created new again. So any life that's out there, what's to become of them when we go through eschatology? That's one thing to consider. But I think to kind of wrap this thought up, if you get into the idea of alien life, and whether or not it has or is even capable of visiting Earth, I mean, that's, again, assuming interstellar travel is possible at all. The best work I've seen, actually, looking at this topic from a Christian perspective is so far only this book of his, C.S. Lewis's Out of the Silent Planet.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's part of his space trilogy. I've read the second book, and I didn't care for that one as much. But the first one really dealt with a lot of those theological hang-ups about what does alien life mean in a biblical and Christian context? In his story, the alien life on Mars, which is the planet they visit in the book, is very aware of that there's a god, and they are under the care of the angel of the planet Mars. You know, so he gets into a sort of pagan territory, but he does it kind of in a way that points to God being part of these aliens' lives.
I do think that C.S. Lewis is misunderstood
in
those ways. I mean, he uses those as literary devices, doesn't he? And I think that's...
I think so, yeah. I don't think he's advocating paganism, but if you wanted to, you could misread it that way, I think. But yeah,
yes, indeed.
I think definitely the underlying message of the book is that there is a God, and that if there's alien life, they know God, and they are under a different dispensation than humanity is. And also, his big thing in the book is that, and the reason why it's called Out of the Silent Planet, is because Earth, because our angel, Satan, is fallen, Earth is under what they call a cosmic quarantine. Basically, no alien life, if it's able to travel between the stars or anywhere, is going to go to Earth because it's forbidden to them. They know that it's not in fellowship with God, right? So,
lovely idea. Yeah,
yeah, and I think that's a great idea, and that would definitely explain a lot of why, if there is interstellar alien life, why it's avoiding us. Maybe, because I would too.
Yeah, I think the important thing to take from that is that these things are very speculative. And all he's doing there, it seems to me anyway, is presenting one thought experiment, or perhaps more importantly, showing that there is an open door to various possibilities when it comes to questions like this.
Yeah.
You know, there are all sorts of issues to think about. Not only is there intelligent life elsewhere, but you know, what if they, as you say, C.S. Lewis seems to be suggesting, they are in a righteous relationship with the Creator? Mm-hmm. What if they're in rebellion against God? Maybe there are different forms of atonement for them that we can't even imagine, you know.
Right.
Do their event timetables coincide with ours? And if not, how is that to be reconciled with you know, cosmic eschatology? All sorts of things to ponder. Not a simple matter at all, but there may be many ways in which to accommodate the biblical perspective.
I think so. Yeah, and I definitely think it is something we hold loosely right now, because I think even like Dr. Heiser has said, we don't have any proof of alien life, so we can't really create any authoritative doctrine on the subject, because we don't have anything to study.
It would be a bit of a waste of time, wouldn't it?
It would. So it's all, you know, basically philosophy and thought experiments at this time. I got into a conversation with my friend Nick about this once, because he and I both love Star Trek. We were talking about kind of how Star Trek and theology work together, because even though Star Trek is very humanistic, you can kind of sometimes see like Christian or biblical principles at work sometimes if you look in the right places. And so I asked him what he thought about the aliens in Star Trek, and he's like, well, almost all of the aliens in Star Trek are basically humanoid. They look like humans, and so they're all capable of reasoning. They're all sentient, for all intents and purposes, very similar to human beings. Because, first of all, that's what the budget allows. Yes.
I know, the amazing thing is they all speak English. This is what astonishes me.
Yeah, and they all speak
with an American accent, most of them, but there we are.
Only the bad guys have British ones. So.
Yes, that's it.
But what his main point was is that these aliens also serve the same purpose as humanity, which is to show that humanoid and reasonable sentient beings are made in the image and likeness of God. And even though these aliens are misshapen by our eyes, they still have the underlying framework of a human being, which is the image and likeness of God and their ability to reason. So that was a very profound thing my friend shared with me. So
that is really interesting. So we're getting our thought experiments on theology from Star Trek. I didn't expect to be talking about that with you today, Frank.
Me either. So that just came out of nowhere. But since you brought up the topic of aliens and we're kind of dissecting it a little bit, I thought that would be worth bringing up. So
it is, absolutely.
So I gave you no solid answer of what I think, other than that there's possibilities I consider, and I'm not holding any of them very tightly. So.
Okay, but we're thinking about these things, and they're to be thought about, but not pronounced upon, because there's very little to go on. Okay, let's turn back to the series themselves, because there are several series, aren't there, of this particular program?
Uh-huh.
I think you say they're still going on, is that right? Do you think they're still making them?
I think they are still making new ones, but I think they are really running out of steam. They've been...
regurgitating the same stuff, presumably.
Yeah, they have been, well, because, I mean, you don't have anybody writing new books on the stuff. You have all the same... parade of faces, you know, just putting up the same stuff over and over again.
Well, I wanted to talk about some of the techniques that seem to come up. Mm-hmm. So I mean, we've got loads and loads of these appeals to authority. Mm-hmm. Just in the words they use, they'll say things like, but researchers believe, some ancient alien mm-hmm. theorists believe, you know, after saying, perhaps this is not accepted in the general academic world, but researchers believe, and it's this sort of mm-hmm. use of the word researchers or theorists. I mean, mostly these are authors. To what extent they're really researchers, I don't know. But using the word believe, not necessarily having any connection to the facts, you know, people can believe whatever. The way mm-hmm. it's presented sounds incredibly authoritative, and I just think it's a little
bland. I agree. So, yeah, on the same hand that they are appealing to authority in researchers with quote fingers, out of the other side of their mouth, they also attack like real authorities on the subject. So that's one of the techniques they use. But I agree with you. They do appeal to authority quite a bit. Yeah. Mm.
I thought there was a lot of leading language in it. So the narrator would often say things like, you know, such and such may be proof of something or other. Well, yeah, maybe proof, but just by using the word sort of suggests that it could well be proof. But mm-hmm. and this is one of their favorite ones that I notice a lot of these researchers use. You cannot exclude the possibility that such and such.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter how outlandish it might seem, somebody will say, but you mm-hmm. cannot exclude the possibility that such and such might be true. And I'm thinking, it's incredibly mm-hmm. difficult to exclude a possibility, a bare possibility. What I want to know is if there's any really good evidence to believe such and such, not just to be told, mm-hmm. no, you can't exclude it.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I think you hit that one right on the head. That's actually one of the they tend to ask a lot of leading questions. You know, could this be evidence of extraterrestrials is a favorite one on the Ancient Aliens show. You can't possibly exclude this possibility or whatever. Yeah. So that's kind of two of the same thing, I think. Yeah, they kind of play that dynamic for sure. And I kind of picked that out in my review of von Daniken's book. And I think especially I did that in one of my book reviews for David Childress was, leading questions often stand in for actual evidence of anything.
Yeah. You mentioned von Däniken there, and I had an example of him precisely doing this mm-hmm. in one of those that I saw, where he's talking about the Martians.
Okay.
The possibility that there may have been Martians who had a war, and then the winners came to Earth.
Oh, yeah.
And then he said, you can't exclude the possibility that this happened. And I thought, yeah, I can't, but so what?
My counter argument would be you can't provide evidence to back up your possibility is what I would respond with.
A big part of it seems to be this sort of narrative weaving. So they'll have mm-hmm. a whole series of claims, and a lot of these claims are a bit dubious, you know, and loosely connected, and mm-hmm. you know, there might be a quick transition to another place on the Earth, and you're thinking, how did we get there, and then switch to somewhere else, and then they will weave this narrative around those claims. And mm-hmm. the impression I get sometimes is that it's all narrative and no facts, really, because the facts seem to be facts because they're somehow embedded in this narrative, which seems to be mm-hmm. everything they're saying.
I agree. Actually, I think you hit on another key strategy of theirs, which is first they have a really compelling narrative. They kind of come up with this story and then present evidence to support that story, whether it fits or not. And then they're using what they call the Gish-Gallop or Gish-Gash fallacy, which is you just spout off a bunch of totally related, unrelated nonsense so quickly that nobody has a chance to refute it. And also, they spout it out without giving any real evidence to back it up.
Isn't that also known as the on-the-spot fallacy?
It could be, yeah. I'm not sure. I need to brush up on my fallacies again.
I know it is the Gish-Gallop.
Yeah.
That's the one.
That is Gish-Gash or Gish-Gallop is the same one, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's where you just rapid fire off claims faster than anybody can debunk them. And actually, I actually did watch the entire first season of Ancient Aliens when I was working on the material for Chris's documentary. And that's what they ended up doing a lot of times is they'd say, okay, this happened down here in South America. And, you know, could it be extraterrestrials? And look over here in this culture. Hey, something's kind of similar, but not really related happened. And that could only be extraterrestrials or this represents, you know, high technology. Yeah. That's a strategy going all the way back to Chariots of the Gods is, you know, in my book review, I noted that is like, I think the exact phrase I had was, you know, von Däniken would jump from one theory to another and one part of the globe to another, like an over caffeinated bumblebee.
that's an extremely good description.
Yeah, that's exactly what I felt like I was reading through the book. and to a certain extent watching the show. Yeah.
Well, I like that description. It's quite affectionate in a way as well, because I like bumblebees.
Thank you. You know, that's the thing about the Chariots of the Gods book. And this charm didn't carry over to any of his other books that I tried reading years ago. He had like almost like a schoolboy enthusiasm in the book. And that's like the only thing that made this book readable to me. Right. He was like so excited about it that you could just tell in his narrative that, you know, he was interested in the subject. And after that, it's just kind of rehashing. So, yeah.
Well, I said to you that I've got this book here called In Search of Ancient Gods by mm-hmm. von Däniken. And it's really a picture book because the subtitle is My Pictorial Evidence for the Impossible. I love that. How can you have evidence for something that's impossible? I don't know whether he's playing with us there with that title. But it's lovely because it's full of these photographs that he's taken from around the world. He's gone all over the place, that's for sure.
Yeah, and the same problem with his photographs I have with the Ancient Aliens show when they are showing things on there is they don't cite their sources. That's another strategy they use also. And especially when they're showing you pictures of things, is they don't tell you what it is necessarily. They may say it's a statue from South America, but they don't give you any context of what it is or any of the citations really. So no. That's definitely one of the strategies they use too.
Yeah, did you watch those episodes that go into the supposed Nazi technology, which is supposedly influenced by aliens?
I haven't, no. Okay. I've only seen the first season, and I only bought the first season, one, to help Chris with the with the video, and two, because it was $5 at Target. So my old library where I used to live had a couple of seasons of it on DVD, but I was having some, you know, things going on in my life, and I just couldn't spend the time watching another season of Ancient Aliens and trying to debunk it, because I've got so many books to debunk already too. So I completely
understand.
But Nazis are a favorite conspiracy go-to guy for sure.
Yes, and you know you'll get people watching if you cover them as well.
Well, and I've jokingly for years called the History Channel the Hitler Channel, because before Ancient Aliens, they had so many documentaries about Hitler and Nazis in World War II. I just, that was like their thing before Ancient Aliens, is that they were the Hitler channel.
Yeah, endless documentaries. And of course, this is what they go for here, isn't it? They copy the documentary style, even though really it's not a documentary.
Yeah.
They've got this very plausible sounding, nice sounding narrator who uses careful language. I've noticed that he never says any of this is true. Mm-hmm. He's always using these rhetorical questions to get you to think that it might be true, but never actually says so. But they bring these genuine experts and academics in, don't they? They have these little cameos.
They try to,
The credentials are displayed there. I wonder to what extent some of those people knew, you know, how their contribution was going to be used.
Well, that's actually an interesting story. First, to mention the credentials of these people, when you look into the credentials of these people, many of them are not like authorities in archaeology or any sort of research like that. Like Jason Colavito actually has looked at the credentials of some of these guys on his website. But moving on there, L.A. Marzulli had actually been in the first season of Ancient Aliens. I think they had talked to him because of his Nephilim angle. And he was actually really interested to go on the Ancient Aliens show, but he was also kind of hesitant. And I think he had talked about this in some of his podcasts and his blog. So I don't feel uncomfortable like sharing this because he made it public. But they had called him on there because of his theories about Genesis 6 and Noah and the Nephilim and all that stuff. Because he had written a fiction trilogy, the Nephilim trilogy, and since then he's gone on to do a lot of related things. But they basically got him in there, and they got him on the show. They asked him all these questions and had him talk about what he knew, which is a more biblical framework than an alien framework.
Did they not want him then? Did they not use that material?
Well, no, they actually did use his footage. However, they edited him in such a way that he was made to look like he was espousing the Ancient Aliens theory. Right. And he was not happy about it because he was so misrepresented. They wanted him to come back again, I heard, and then he refused to do it, which good for him.
Yeah.
But instead, he went on to create his Watchers series of DVDs in response to Ancient Aliens, which I won't comment on those too much, other than I'm not a big viewer of those.
Well, nor I, yes. Maybe we'll come back to that scene in a little bit. You mentioned about not all these people are actually as qualified as they seem to be, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I did look at a couple here. We have Michael Denin, who apparently is Professor of Physics and Astronomy at University of California, Irvine. Or is it Irvine?
Irvine.
Yeah. But I looked at a little interview with him where he said it was fun being on this. And he did because he said he could inject some science into the program, which I thought was interesting.
Okay.
And there's a quote from him. He says, there could be alien life very different from us, but if we'd been visited by aliens, I can't imagine it could be kept a secret.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't really go along with it, but he thought it would be fun and... You know, thinks the idea of alien life is fine, it could be very different from us. But the really interesting thing I thought was he thought, ah, this is an opportunity to get some science into a program which doesn't have enough science in it, perhaps.
Yeah. I would say, yeah, if someone like him was on there, they'd probably be trying to, like him or even Marzulli, they were trying to get in their own perspective on things.
Yeah.
This guy, his science, and Marzulli, the Nephilim angle. I would think that they can go ahead and say that, but the History Channel, if they go along with it, would leave it in. But if it doesn't kind of flow with the narrative they're trying to give, then they'll edit around that. I don't think they have any problems with that.
Yeah. The only thing I noticed from the few that I saw was that the experts who were brought on tended to say the more thought experimenty kind of things, or the more standard bits of science and observation that would fit into the narrative, but it was the more extreme stuff was coming from these quote-unquote researchers.
Yeah, I think that should tell you something.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There was a big thing on this false dichotomy, or the false dilemma, as it's sometimes called.
Yeah.
So you'll have, I mean, this is an example from the elongated skulls that came up in the programs, found in places like Peru, Egypt, and other places. And they would say things like, so we have to wonder, were they a different race, or were they extraterrestrials? There's no third option given, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like, were they humans subject to some kind of skull lengthening or something like that?
Yeah.
So therefore, you're invited to dismiss A, and therefore you're tempted to say, oh, well, it must be B then. You know, they don't mention C, D, E,
right.
F. And they do this in the opening sequence, right at the beginning of the program. They have, what would you call it, a pentalemma? I don't know. They have this authoritative sound of music, and the space images roll in front of you. And you get, we get these five rhetorical questions, and they go, who were they? Why did they come? What did they leave behind? Where did they go? Will they return? And I thought, why don't they say, are they just fake? is this all hogwash? You know, but they don't. And so you're primed right at the beginning of the program to think, oh, I'm going to be addressing these questions. You know, so it was that same technique right from the beginning.
Yeah, they start right from a false assumption right there, Exactly.
Okay, well, we talked a little bit about some of the people involved. Eric von Däniken, and you mentioned David Childress there. So he, I believe, is the author of Technology of the Gods. He apparently, you say, did some sort of reaction to you in print.
He did. So for everyone who doesn't know, David Hatcher Childress, he's a guest on Ancient Aliens. And prior to Ancient Aliens, he was often writing books mostly about like Atlantis type of things and intercontact between races before they should have, kind of diffusionist stuff. And then kind of on Ancient Aliens, he was kind of leaning more alien-like. And back around the time I wrote the article, I was unemployed at the time, and I was like looking to still write stuff for this because hoping I could maybe get work doing this sort of work or something, debunking things. I will debunk for money. But
well, as I said to you before the interview, when I'm in a position to employ you, I will come straight to you, Frank.
So I'll start buying lotto tickets, right? And anyway, I was in a coffee shop and kind of bored looking for jobs that day, and I had exhausted those options. And so I don't know what led me to it, but I found on some website somewhere that David Childress had been part of a documentary about these stone balls in Costa Rica. And his main premise about these stone balls in Costa Rica was that they could only have been made by power tools. That was his evidence, was that they only could have been made. He didn't provide any power tools for evidence, unfortunately.
Yeah, this only could have been made by comes up a lot in Ancient Aliens, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially by Childress.
Sure. And I mean, I'm fine with that inference to the best explanation way of arguing. I think that's a very powerful way of arguing.
Mm-hmm.
But you really have to be sure that you've eliminated all the possibilities.
Yeah.
And looking at that documentary, if you can call it a documentary, no, it isn't, is it? You're looking at that set of programs, I'm thinking, I have not the slightest confidence that they've eliminated all the possibilities. And then when you go over to Chris White's debunkumentary, you find there are all sorts of academic materials that they've chosen to be completely quiet about, and Chris has ferreted them out, and there they are, alternative explanations, which make a lot of sense. Anyway, back to David Childress, go on.
Yeah, so I had debunked his video. That it was on this UFO TV website, that's where I found it, and so I kind of picked a few of his major claims out of there, basically did a debunking of his stone balls, because he said that they were from some sort of ancient sea civilization, basically like an Atlantis sort of thing, and they had washed up after some calamity on all these different shores around the world. Similar looking spheres are actually painted red and put in front of almost every Target store we have also, so I don't know if that's a connection, but so I finally had gotten work a couple of months later, and I was on my lunch break taking a walk at the local mall, and for kicks I went into the local Barnes and Noble and was just looking at the, you know, weird magazines to see if there's anything interesting to debunk. And what do I see? Like on one of these magazines, I see something about the stone spheres of Costa Rica. And I'm like, what? I just did a blog about that a couple of months ago. And I pick it up and I look inside and there's an article talking about me in David Childress's World Explorer magazine. I really couldn't afford it at the time, but I just had to buy a copy of it. Yeah, because
sure.
He also, in addition to like kind of attacking or picking apart my debunking, I think he called me by the wrong name, first of all.
You know, I was wondering what was going through his mind. Was he thinking, this wretched Frank Johnson, I'll teach him. I'll get him to buy a copy of my magazine.
I don't know how he even found me. Like, is he reading my blog and I don't know about it? Weird. And so I'm like, this is so strange. He's attacking me in his magazine. This is awesome. And
yeah, indeed. It must have been a great moment for you.
It was kind of a great moment. It was shock, surprise, and pride all at the same time. It's an interesting and kind of well put together magazine for what it is, but it's, you know, full of nonsense for the most part.
I guess one of the most amusing people for me anyway on the show is this guy called Giorgio Tsoukalos. He's a publisher, apparently, of Legendary Times magazine. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that may have something to do with Eric von Däniken, but I may be wrong about that.
You know, I don't know much about Giorgio other than what I've read through Jason Colavito's blog. Mm-hmm. And basically, this Legendary Times magazine, I don't think is actually even a magazine anymore. I think it's like, if it ever was a magazine, it was like a very short-lived one, because I don't think you can buy it. I think he had something on his website. You can go to his website and maybe buy like it's a newsletter or something is what it was. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if they still put it out. So
yeah, I'll have a look for that. I mean, the thing about him is that, I comment upon him. He puts himself out there, so I'm going to comment upon him. And that is that I find him the most entertaining of the characters in the show, but the least convincing, to be honest. He's extremely enthusiastic about what he's talking about, but the way he presents himself, of course, his hair particularly, which is unmistakable, there never seems to be anything that comes from him which I would describe as evidential. That just seems to be his whole way of sort of presenting or selling the idea of it. But I strain to think of him in terms of a researcher. He doesn't give that impression.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I think he maybe started out because I think he had been part of the like president of the von Däniken fan club or something along those lines years ago as part of his magazine thing. So all that's kind of tied in together. Mm. And I think he had, not really ever done anything that's research worthy. And then I think he got put on this show because he either helped create it or put it together or something. And I'm kind of shooting from my hip here on this. I don't really know, but he kind of got involved with it. And I think because he was such a standout personality and kept showing up, I think he started to play toward the internet memes and started, because if you watch his hair from each season, it gets like more and more crazy especially once he's like, once he's a little bit more established as Crazy Haired Giorgio, he kind of plays into it a little bit more. So
I mean, as a PR thing, it was a great success, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. I think he just was good at milking that meme and then sticking with it, yeah.
I mean, every time he comes on, I'm, you know, part of me is thinking, oh, good, it's him again, you know. I enjoy him. But I don't feel like I learn a great deal then.
Well, you're right, yeah. And I think without him on that show, I don't think the show probably would have been around for as long as it was. So. Actually, I did Google here the evolution of Giorgio Tsoukalos's hair. And you can see in the first season, he looks somewhat respectable. He's got like, you know, his hair is not even like crazy at all. Hmm. And he's got like a really nice suit on. And then they show four pictures. There's like his hair getting more and more wild.
Lovely.
And so
it was a great idea. I have to give them that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's definitely part of the success of the show is like he decided to kind of stick with it and have fun with it, I think. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the substance that's actually put forward. One that I'd like to talk about is the Greys. I don't know how much they talk about it over all the series, but the one that I saw here, obviously they're talking about this alien image, you know, with the big head, the big almond-shaped eyes, greyish skin, small body, little limbs, the typical sort of illustration of extraterrestrials that we're all familiar with. And the claim is made that ancient drawings and figurines from all over the place, maybe, you know, they always say this, maybe depictions by ancient people of these greys, documenting times when they were visited from outer space or from other dimensions by these greys. How much do you know about this image, where it came from, Frank?
Well, that's a really interesting topic. I think it can come from a lot of different places. I think what we have here with the Greys in terms of like ancient aliens is them being part of the modern UFO culture for whatever reason we can get into. And then us looking back at the ancient alien thing and saying, hey, look, here's Greys that are in our narrative now. Here, if I squint, I can see them back here kind of thing, maybe.
Yes. Yeah, I really noticed that. They would find these various figurines.
Yeah.
They'd superimpose the head of the grey over this. And I'm thinking, if you didn't superimpose it over the top, I'd never think they were very much like each other.
Yeah, that's maybe one of the things going on. At least one of the ancient hieroglyphs I've seen of the greys, the supposed ones, it was actually a hieroglyph of something else kind of taken out of context and not really looking like a gray if you don't superimpose a picture on it. The only other one that I know of, now there could be others that I've not seen, and there probably are, but down in Australia, there's cave or rock art that has kind of weird looking creatures that sort of kind of look gray alien like, but those, I haven't dealt with those on my blog yet, and I've been meaning to do it for years, but that's one subject I'm planning to do one day when I get back to it.
Sure. It's interesting, you know, you can find an example somewhere of them looking, as you say, kind of like it, but they supposedly show, you know, these examples from all over the place, and they're giving the impression that these are describing the same kind of phenomenon. And I'm straining sometimes,
yeah,
in the examples that they're showing to think, well, is that really like what the greys look like? I'm not convinced. You know, it's a bulbous head with a couple of sort of almond eyes. Well, that's not a lot to go on. Some of them don't even conform to that very well.
You're right, yeah. So, I mean, I kind of agree with you. A lot of these ancient ones are not really very close. So, like, kind of backing up to your question then is, where does the modern picture of the greys come from? And I think we have a few different starting places. So my first memory of seeing a grey alien thing was I was with my parents in the shopping mall, you know. We walked past the bookstore, and the book cover for the supposedly true book, Communion, was there. And I don't know if you're familiar with that abduction account, but
I'm not familiar with it. I've heard of it. So I think you may have told me about it at one point.
I may, yeah. So it was like very popular in the mid to late 80s. Whitley Strieber was the author of this book. And actually, even now, like looking at the cover to that book just kind of unsettles me, because it's like, I've looked at other depictions of gray aliens, but that one is like the most sinister, I want to say, is the disturbing of all of them, I think. And I really don't like that picture. So that's kind of my first memory of it. And then from there, as I grew into reading UFO literature as a teenager, the gray alien then became kind of more of a staple of the abduction narrative after that point. It became really much more popular then. But the earliest real gray alien you can kind of point to in abduction literature is, I think, the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. It's often kind of referred to as like the first, you know, modern abduction. It's not really, but it's kind of the one that kind of put it into the popular mind. Betty and Barney Hill were, he was a black man and she's a white woman back in the 60s in America when race relations were not really so good. So what happened is these two were abducted on a country road, supposedly, and then they later came up with this story that they'd experienced some sort of abduction, and they were basically abducted by what comes out as like space Nazis, and then also there was like a gray alien component in there.
Sorry, space Nazis, what are they?
Yeah, like human-like beings that supposedly abducted them also, who were described in the story as very like Nazi-like or something like that. So they have been referred to as space Nazis at some point. So, yeah. And then they were shown a map of the Zeta Reticuli system where the grays supposedly come from. But even that's kind of up for debate, actually. So,
did they describe them looking as they're often depicted then?
They kind of did. And what the origin of that was determined to be, at least by, I think, Jason, was that they had actually been watching The Outer Limits. And there had been an episode or two of The Outer Limits that these two had been watching or possibly could have been watching that played a factor into it. And then what happened later, too, is all of these details came out under hypnosis. So under hypnosis, you have, a couple of things going on. You have either they're just on a totally human level, being totally open to suggestion and whatever the hypnotizer says. And you also have maybe a spiritual component as well, you know, working some sort of deception, perhaps. So and add that those two things together with watching kind of at the time, intense sci-fi show like Outer Limits, and you got a...
Yeah, there are a lot of factors in there, I agree.
Yeah, that's where I kind of can see that coming from. And then Betty Andreessen abduction from the... I think she claimed her experiences happened in the 60s or 70s. Hers involved grays too, but her grays were different than the ones in, I think, Communion and also... See, that's the thing, is everybody kind of describes them differently up into a certain point, and then they kind of get a more consistent facade. But Betty Andreessen kind of made it seem like these were almost like human beings, but like they were kind of modified in such a way that they were kind of gray aliens instead of... So like they were still kind of human, I think, but maybe not. It's her story is also unclear, and also her abduction story has like a ton of hypnosis involved in it, so... Hers involved gray aliens. And I'm kind of jumping around the timeline a little bit more. Somebody else, and I don't know how much stock I'd put in this, but somebody else has even tied the gray alien back to Aleister Crowley. So
I was going to ask you the same thing. I've heard this as well, that he may have drawn something rather like that way back.
Yeah, I don't know how much of a showman he was versus how much of an actual sinister person he was. So I don't really know, but... If you take one of his drawings he did of a certain entity, it's got kind of the bulbous head, and the picture he drew has very tiny eyes at the bottom. But what happens is somebody took those and kind of superimposed, because there's some details on there that you can kind of play with and make it look like a gray alien if you really want to. And I find that interesting, if nothing else. But there you go.
You implied, correct me if I'm wrong, that this gray alien has become more standardized over time. Is that true?
I feel like it, yeah, because when I was reading about UFOs and abductions, and especially seeing it on shows like The X-Files and in movies and stuff, I feel like they've gotten a more consistent look, and also in their purposes, perhaps. Mm. Early on, like in the Andreessen abduction, you have the breeding program thing of some sort. And then they're also tangentially concerned with the environment and also sometimes like spiritual matters. But their standard narrative in more modern times, once you get to about the late 80s and early 90s in the X-File thing, is they're generally aliens here to tell us about the environment and strangely enough to give us spiritual advice about reincarnation and all this kind of nonsense.
Yes, I picked that up from the Raelian New Religious Movement, but I did see an illustration, I believe it was produced by the Raelians themselves, which showed something looking much more humanoid. So they don't seem to have gone along with that grey depiction.
Okay.
I mean, one thing that I wanted to ask you is, do you think that this is very much a Western phenomenon, this grey thing, or does it go right across the globe?
Well, that's the thing. I think some researchers, and some researchers in quotes, would say that it's a global thing, but... For sure, one of the early abductions before the Hill one was in Brazil, I think, and he described something that was kind of really different. Certain parts of the world have sometimes reported different, quote-unquote, aliens, depending on the region of the globe they're at. And also, there used to be a timeline of alien abductions that kind of, from early on, it showed like all sorts of varieties of aliens, and occasionally a gray alien, and a lot of times weird-shaped and robots and insectoid ones, furry things, and all kinds of strange stuff. And then when you get to a certain point in time, they tend to become mostly all grays. But other parts of the globe have reported, like, reptilian ones are kind of popular. Nordic-looking ones are also popular. Those ones would be, I think, more European, because, like, you have the... And although I think he's been outed as a fraud more recently, Billy Meyer in Germany, he was... reporting more of the Nordic looking aliens. So I think in like Europe was more of a Nordic flavor. I think it depends like a lot in where you're at in the world. Like
that's what I'm wondering, if people are seeing what they expect to see. That's
that could be part of it, sure.
That's what I would, you know, immediately think might be going on. Not to suggest that that disproves that there might be some spiritual element to this, but, you know, if there is a spiritual element, you know, an evil spiritual element to this, then it seems to me that those spirits would most likely use what's already inside your head, you know?
I think so, and that could definitely be why they're taking on a more... gray look for the most part, because that's what people are expecting to see. Because in other cultures, like if you get into sleep paralysis, like I spoke once to somebody who's from China who had sleep paralysis, and this person from China reported she saw this sort of being from the Chinese mythology, you know, ringing a bell, collecting the dead souls or whatever. So I think what Chris White always says, they're gonna use what's gonna work to deceive you. So if you're expecting aliens, they're going to give you aliens. If you want fairies, they'll give you fairies, you know? Not to bring it back to fairies, I'm traumatized. But, I mean, that is one thing you can...
It's a fixation there. We mentioned the Nephilim thing earlier on, and actually in this one that I saw, they do make a Nephilim kind of connection. I think they don't actually mention them, but they make the claim that this theme of otherworldly visitors finding human females attractive is found in various places in the ancient world. I think they say the Hopi Indian culture has this with the Kachinas, and they make reference to the elongated humanoid skulls in Peru, Egypt, other places. And they say that maybe these are evidence of human-alien hybrids. So that does kind of connect there, doesn't it, with the Nephilim thing of Genesis 6. How do you understand the connection there?
Yeah, okay. So when I got into the whole abduction thing and was looking for a Christian response to like abduction stuff, I did kind of see a lot of people saying, okay, you know, you have the abduction phenomena creating a hybrid breeding program with aliens and stuff. And then look here in from a biblical perspective, you have Genesis 6, and then you have, you know, the watchers and angels, you know, mating with human women and producing giants and all that. And so that's kind of where it started with the Christian side of things. And I think from there, it's kind of gotten a little bit out of hand, as I probably have said in other places, but
I agree with you. I think it has got out of hand. I think that's a good way of describing that. As I said before on this show, I do find it difficult to interpret that, that very small passage there in Genesis 6, but the theology that's woven out of this seems to be quite out of proportion to that, and I find some of it quite disturbing, so I steer clear of it.
Yeah, I kind of think that's a wise move, because I think, you know, even if that is what happened back then, it's not necessarily what's happening now. You know, it doesn't mean because in the days of Noah that was happening that that's going to happen now. That's maybe a misinterpretation of what Jesus was saying there. You know, in the days of Noah, nobody was expecting the flood to come is what he's talking about. You know, it came suddenly and without warning is what I think he's...
I totally agree with you.
Yeah. ...driving at. Yeah, I think most people are missing that point. It's not the Nephilim are coming back. That's not what he's talking about. He's telling you to be ready for judgment to come at any minute or at any time. That part of the Nephilim paradigm is where I take issue. The other part of where I take issue with the modern Nephilim thing, well, one part of it, at least from a biblical point of view, is people take the Daniel, you know, the vision Nebuchadnezzar had with the statue, you know, the gold head, and the feet and of iron and clay and all that. Mm. They kind of torture the text on that one to have the toes of the statue being, they're like, and they will mingle their seed. Well, who's they? That's, and I'm not picking on any one person here. A lot of people hold this view now. They're nitpicking that they, and that's not the point of that statue. The statue up until that point about the toes is all kingdoms and stuff, you know, and then why suddenly at the end it's about a breeding program with Nephilim? It doesn't make sense. You know, the people who I think were meaning well, trying to find a Christian explanation for this. And this is where I think the real error is. They took these abductions and breeding program accounts as fact and at face value, instead of looking at those claims a little more carefully. What I found is the problem, at least in all of the abduction accounts I've read, many of them, if not all of them, are usually retrieved through hypnosis. David Jacobs, the guy who's early on quoted by a lot of Christian researchers, he's actually a legit psychology PhD at some university. And he interviewed a bunch of people who'd had abduction experiences. And he found that these people were reporting some sort of breeding program happening. And basically, he put his research out, not in a scholarly paper. He put it out in a book because even he knew it was kind of like too out there for his peers to review. I give him credit for, I guess, putting it out there. But the problem is we're accepting it as an actual happening when we are not taking into account that all of his evidence, at least in, I read his book, The Threat, about his alien breeding program, and all of it was based on hypnosis that I remember. So that's what I think where our error was in working up a modern Nephilim narrative these days. We can say it happened back in Genesis 6. I don't really have a problem with that. I don't think you're going to find like evidence of it in an ancient alien context, because the flood wiped it out, I think, if it was a thing. And you're not getting it in a modern context because, one, you have to torture the Bible's text to make it say that, and then you also are basing your assumption on a false premise, which is what the ancient aliens people do. And that's testimony retrieved largely through hypnosis. You know, I've talked a little bit privately with Joe Jordan of CE4 research about it and kind of read some of his work. And he's really strongly of the opinion that all of this stuff is like illusion. So if there is these experiences happening, it's a spiritual deception. And you know, his whole ministry is framed around helping people get out of that. So, I mean, that's where I'm kind of at with that whole thing.
That does make a lot of sense, because there does seem to be an awful lot of deception surrounding mm-hmm. this whole area. So if that was, in fact, a spiritual strategy, it's worked pretty well.
Yeah, it has.
On many different fronts.
Well, and if you think about, too, I think this summer is actually coming up on the 70th anniversary of the Roswell, New Mexico supposed UFO crash.
Yes.
About the same amount of time since the first major UFO sighting with Kenneth Arnold, when he first coined the term flying saucers. And we have, just even for flying saucers, we have so little like actual physical evidence, you know. After 70 years, if this was like some sort of like physical phenomenon, we would have found something more convincing by now. And, you know, while I haven't looked at every single exact, every case, you know, a lot of the physical evidence that's presented is not really very good. And a lot of the pictures are not very good. So,
well, you say that, Frank, but, you know, if I go back to the Ancient Alien series here, I've got a wonderful quote here from Philip Coppens, one of these mm-hmm. researchers. This is his quote. Science, NASA in this case, has really made a huge lunge forward. We've left the field of possibility. We've entered the real, where ancient alien theory is no longer a theory, but is really coming closer and closer to evidence, if not proof. So, as far as he is concerned, anyway, this is pretty close to being proof, almost QED.
So he's thinking the modern abduction phenomena is kind of a sealing the deal? Is that what he's getting at?
I'm trying to think what it actually did refer to. I know what it was. Well, you see, this is the trouble. You don't know, because these little interviews are put into the narrative and you don't actually know precisely what they're referring mm-hmm. to. But the NASA connection here, I think, in the narrative was life might have once existed on Mars because of the presence of water. And then they were saying exoplanets, inhabitable zones, you know, in other solar systems. And then they immediately cut to Coppens saying this.
Gotcha. Okay, so that must be what they were getting at. I would even say that, well, the evidence for life on Mars now or ever having been there is I haven't seen enough to convince me. I don't have a problem with it necessarily, but yeah. Yeah, I don't think Mr. Coppins's quote is really as authoritative as he thinks it is. But
no.
Yeah.
And the thing that I really loved about this section, which is why I want to talk about it really, is because they then they have this guy called Ken Storch who comes on and says that maybe these greys are our space brothers. You probably hear a little baby crying in the other room. Sorry.
I did. Yes, I did. I hope we didn't wake him up with all this talk of aliens.
I'm sure he's blissfully unaware of most things at the moment. So this Ken Storch talks about the space brothers, and then George Noory comes on saying that maybe we were made in their image, and so directly connecting it to the biblical concept of being made in the image of God. So we therefore get a reinterpretation of the Genesis meaning into something like we were created by the greys according to the pattern of their DNA. But then it moves on another step, which is, I thought was fascinating. This is my favorite bit, where somebody says, and I think it might have been the folklorist specialist, this lady, I'm not sure, but she says something like, and these are not her exact words. Oh no, these are her exact words, actually. Some say they might be time travel from our own future, and then the line is added that they may have come to warn us about our own future. So the impression there is given that maybe these greys are some sort of highly evolved or highly engineered forms of us in some way from the future, coming back in time to tell us things. But then I was thinking, well, if that's the case and they've created us, then doesn't that mean some sort of future form of us has come back in time to make us in the first place? At that point, I thought, I don't even know what I'm listening to here. This doesn't even seem coherent.
Yeah, well, I've heard that in some of the, when I used to read the New Age magazines, people who would talk about, you know, perhaps UFOs or aliens, or the greys are us from the future. But you know, they can't be both. Well, I mean, I guess I'm sure someone would be able to say they could be both, but it's kind of hard for them to be both aliens and us from the future, you know, aliens from a different star system and us from the future. It gets very speculative at that point then. It's like, well, did they always come back? Are they altering the timeline or did they?
Yes.
And why aren't they taking a more firm hand with fixing things from the past? Why not go back in time and stop Hitler? Why not come back and give us technology? Then when you ask questions like that, then the people will say, well, we're not mature enough as a race and a species yet, and they're here to help enlighten us. Which aliens or time travelers, they kind of have the same sort of goal, which is to teach us kind of new agey things, basically.
Messes with your head, as the phrase goes.
Yeah.
As does indeed the wonderful thing where they had the Greek god Poseidon with his trident, or Neptune in the Roman religion, saying that it might have been some kind of extraterrestrial energy weapon. I think this is David Childress.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
He says, you have to wonder if this trident wasn't a high-tech extraterrestrial device.
One last thing I would want to say about the future greys versus alien greys is I don't know that they could be both, because everybody's accounts would be very contradictory then. You have like one person, Nancy Leader, who supposedly channels the greys, and they don't speak human language, so they have to communicate to her via word pictures. But yet, if that's the case, how can they be people from the future who then are back here and actually using actual words and talking to other people who they're abducting? And it's like, you know, if the gray aliens as a race are working on some sort of unified goal, the left hand doesn't seem to know what the right is doing, which makes me wonder, why would we want to get their help in the first place if they're that disorganized? But
indeed, I really do think all these people who put this series together needed to get around the table properly and work out one single unified theory about this, because it has messed with my head and I don't know what they're actually saying half the time.
say what you want about plot inconsistencies in Star Wars and Star Trek, at least they have an overall continuity that sort of works in a larger picture.
Yeah. The last thing really I wanted to really draw people's attention to is the megalithic evidences, because they do go into Pumapunku and other places, and you know, they actually go there on the site and they look at these various massive stones that are there, and they say, look how all these cuts that are made into the stone at right angles and how smooth they are, and they, you know, saying how could they have been made other than by using high-end technology, and where would they have got that from at the time? Must have come from outer space, you know, where else could it have come from? And then when you look at the fantastic documentary that Chris made, he goes to all these academic materials, finding that there are in fact explanations for these things. and so much of it just crumbles, really. Do you want to have anything to say about that angle of things?
Yeah, I think moving the huge blocks, that's been one of the biggest arguments by the ancient aliens and even ancient high technology people, is that, you know, there's no way primitive people could have moved these huge blocks because they're just too big. A lot of times other people will say, you know, they had, you know, levitation machines, or they used sound machines to levitate stones, and yeah, just kind of all kinds of crazy stuff.
And so this is involving trumpets or something, isn't it? Well, the trumpets, and somehow the sound is involved in levitation.
It depends on who you ask, I think.
Okay, okay.
But anyway, I thought we discussed that it was all dinosaurs.
so we did, Frank. Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, I forget what it is. So yeah, I mean, I think in the video, Chris really did a good job of explaining the pyramids. And I think even since then, we've kind of, in one of the blogs, maybe uncovered some more recent research that showed how they move the blocks, because there's hieroglyphics that actually show how they did it. They put the huge blocks on sleds, and then they poured water on the sand, which made it, I guess, a little more viscous. And they were able to use a lot of muscle work and a lot of people pulling the things across the sand on sleds. It could be done, you know? And I think actually, because they're so easy to prove, the pyramids were normal, that's why the ancient alien crowd has moved on to other sites and other pyramids. Like Baalbek is a huge, well, it's literally huge, and it's also a huge foundation to the ancient aliens theory. And in fact, I think turned up in season one. But actually, I quoted in my book review of Chariots of the Gods that an article Michael Heiser had put out that showed how they moved those. There was a French paper that was written that showed they would carve out these gigantic, huge blocks that were supposedly impossible to move. They would build these huge wooden wheels around the pillar, and then they would basically just wheel these things to where they needed them to go. And then they showed how they moved them into place with pulleys and ropes and stuff. So that one is also easy to explain. And even when you talk about the weight of these things being impossible for people to move, the ancient aliens crowd forgets that I think it's the Thunderstone in Russia is the largest stone ever moved by humankind, and it did not require aliens, and nobody claimed aliens moved it for them. So, and they used it without any modern technology at all. So figure that one out.
And going back to Pumapunku, the claim was made in the show that you couldn't have rolled these stones along because there were no trees around. And they just sort of left it at that. Kind of, it was such a high altitude, there wouldn't trees be growing there and all that sort of thing. And I thought at the time, well, why couldn't they get trees from somewhere else? And that's exactly what Chris says in the documentary. And I thought the same thing, Chris. They do this, don't they? So often they leave out information so that you don't have that option unless you happen to think of it yourself.
Exactly. Come on, curse you and your critical thinking. That was a big thing on Easter Island. That was a big claim. The big heads, the moai they have there. People say, oh, they couldn't have moved these huge stone things because there's no trees. Well, first of all, they deforested the island. so there's no trees now. That doesn't mean there never were trees. Yes. And second of all, there's even a new theory of how they were moved. It's not new anymore, but they had them standing up and they just kind of used muscle work and ropes to just kind of wobble them to where they needed them to go. So, you know, again, you have no need for alien technology. So,
well, one thing that,
or even trees.
Well, there's one good thing I think that can be said about this is that when you look at the program, then you start having all these questions. If you're thinking about what you're actually watching, you're like, well, is it really the case? Are there no other explanations? And it does then give you the impetus to go and find out if there are explanations. And then that can open up all sorts of fields of inquiry that you might not previously have even thought about looking into. So when I look at Chris's documentary, I found it fascinating. All sorts of things that I never would even have bothered to look at before, but because the documentary is throwing these things up, that becomes a possibility. So I suppose one could say good for them for doing that. I don't think that's what they're trying to do.
It's not.
They're not trying to encourage research, but that's in effect what does happen with some people who are watching this. So maybe from that point of view, we could say it does some good.
I think in that point, you could say that is about the only thing that comes out of it, is that, and just in my own experience in looking at this stuff and researching and writing about it, I've really actually learned a lot of interesting things I never would have otherwise.
Yes.
But unfortunately, I don't think the average person, and not that I'm some super genius, because I'm actually just a regular guy too, but most people are just going to sit there and watch it and then walk away and work that into their worldview, unfortunately. So.
Yeah.
I think it's a very small minority of people are actually going to stop and research this. I think we can see that not just with ancient aliens, but when you look into the, you know, some of the Christian fringe topics too, is the large populace of people is going to just accept it and then poo-poo anybody who tries to discredit it, unfortunately.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, why I've invited you to come on and talk about this, because this is very much a sort of Christian worldview podcast, and I wanted to go into this because I think you're absolutely right. A lot of people have been affected by it and continue to be affected by it and mm-hmm. sort of weave it into their worldview, and it's not a good thing to be doing. So it's good to look at this and, as you say, apply your critical faculties to it and see what's really going on. So thanks ever so much, Frank, for coming on. It has been not only interesting but also fun. I do like speaking to you. You've got a great sense of humour. Mm-hmm. And before we go, a couple of things really. Could you direct people to the Ancient Aliens Debunked blog? How do you get there?
Sure. You can go to ancientaliensdebunked.com, and in there you can find all sorts of tabs that take you to references and transcripts and videos. There's a tab for blogs, which is where all of my work is, to kind of serve as a research resource for people who are like really want to think about it and look at these claims and find other explanations. So
and you can find the documentary on there as well, can't you?
You can try to watch it from the website, but the website now basically is mostly for the blog, I think, than anything else. And unfortunately, I haven't done much with the blog lately. So
have you got any plans coming up?
I've always got plans. I just I would like to do more blogging. I just am kind of at a, I don't know what I should be doing with myself. So if you want more blogs, I don't know, encourage me and I don't know.
Give you subject matters that might get under your skin. Maybe that's the answer.
Yeah, maybe start talking about flat earth and hollow earth. I mean, I have plenty to do that I could do. It's just, I'm just not sure if it's really the best use of my time is, I guess, what I'm maybe beating around the bush about. So.
Well, absolutely. We all go through these periods, don't we? We question what we're doing and and waiting for guidance to come. Absolutely. Fair enough.
So if anyone has insights, please let me know. I will gladly entertain any suggestions. So.
Okay. Well, you heard that on the show. Please do contact Frank. Yeah.
I did make an Ancient Alien Debunked Facebook group.
Okay.
If people come in there and want to have, like, you know, talk about the blogs or the movie Chris did, or ask like sincere questions about some of the claims made by ancient alienites or some of the debunkings I've made or question my logic on things, I'd be happy to talk about it maybe. So yeah, that'd be the best way to get in touch with me is in the Facebook group on, I guess, Facebook. So yeah.
Okay, you'll give me that link then. I'll put that in the show notes and people can connect with you through that if they want to ask you anything.
Good. Sure, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Frank. It's been a great discussion. Look forward to speaking to you on New Year's Eve.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Julian. I enjoyed our talk and I always like talking to you. And my last word of advice today is than.
That's an in-joke, everybody. You'll have to email me and ask. You'll indeed contact Frank and ask what that's all about. But yes, than. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
I'm flying in the plane, I'm always hallucinating. But who really knows what I'm looking at, you know what I'm saying? I'm always hallucinating. I'm flying in the plane, I'm hallucinating. I don't even know, but who really knows? We're going out to like the Air Force One or find all that stuff, figure something out. But there's no proof, just people's accounts. Oh yeah, yes sir, they're out there, man. Think of made of anything, extraterrestrial. Yes sir.